One of the many good reasons we should all be glad that we're Australian and not America these days has to involve guns. It's interesting, both countries share colonial origins, violent beginnings, and gun ownership played a major part in the evolution of our nations, if not the deciding role in some of the outcomes in staking ownership over land, the dispossession of our indigenous population, and preventing those convict classes from gun ownership. Now, I was mentioning before the anniversary today of the 1996 Port Arthur massacre saw us become the world leader in the regulation of firearms, but those firearm figures are creeping up and up and up, and we've now got a hell of a lot more guns than we've ever had at any time in our history. Nick Brody joins me now. Nick's an historian and author of a number of books, which have been discussed on our program, and his latest is Under Fire: How Australia's Violent History Led to Gun Control. Nick, welcome back.
Thanks, Philip. Nice to speak to you again.
I think we must acknowledge that the very first gunshot fired on Australian soil was by roll of drums, Captain Cook at Botany Bay.
Well, it was actually fired by William Dampier on the West Coast about 100 years before that, but Cook certainly is probably the most resonant shot to be fired in Australian history.
And it's only recently been, admitted to, in a sense.
Yes, it's a funny thing that event is so iconic. You know, they even painted that image of him firing to scare off the Aboriginal men standing in defiance. But it's a forgotten part of the whole narrative as we fixate on him mapping and raising the flag and claiming and kind of forget the shooting part.
How important were guns to this country in our early days?
Absolutely crucial, really. I mean, the colonial project would not have succeeded without firearms. Our history neatly maps, in a way, the rise of modern firearms, so that Australia, a bit like America, you know, those centuries of that 17th, 18th century colonial endeavours from Europe is the period when Europeans are taking up firearms on a massive way, and they're becoming smaller, more portable, people are becoming more familiar with their use. And so that changes the dynamic of warfare and gives them a huge advantage that if they'd moved in only 200 or so years beforehand, they wouldn't have had. So it's a big deciding factor in the success story of colonisation.
Now, let's talk about the passage in 1996 of the National Firearms Agreement. It was monumental, long time coming. But like all such achievements, of course, vigilance is needed.
Yeah, I think over the longer history of Australia's story of gun control, Port Arthur takes pride of place, but it risks creating a bit of a national myth that Australia had a problem with guns until 1996 and then it didn't. Our story is really one where there is periodic need to reform gun law and regulation of firearms. Port Arthur of those is extremely iconic and deservedly so, because it really tips us into a firm national approach towards firearms. And it's really the National Firearms Agreement that gives us the edge over America, for instance. It's that sense of a national approach to this issue. But that agreement has been updated a couple of times since then. As you've mentioned in the introduction, firearms have continued to increase. So it's one of those things that needs ongoing reform, as all law does.
Well, looking at your material, it would seem that if one extrapolates over the next couple of years, we'll be approaching 4 million guns.
Yeah, it's a little scary, isn't it? But, of course, part of that is, as with the Port Arthur handbag, many of those were redundant guns. So the numbers don't really speak to the number of active, you know, top-end lethal weapons. Many of them are just second-hand weapons that have no longer, they've sort of outserved their use, and so they're sitting in somebody's shed. But in many ways, they are the most dangerous sort of guns, because they're the ones that children get access to. They're the ones which, when domestic situations escalate, people snap and grab those weapons. So it's constantly, we need to constantly remind ourselves that the guns are dangerous and we should only have them if we really need them.
A part of the pushback, of course, has come from, phenomena like the Shooters, Fishers and Farmers Party, for example. And I should say in parenthesis that was originally established by Laura Tingle's father.
Yeah, they're quite a recent phenomenon, really. If you look at the longer sweep, you know, the 200-year history of gun control in Australia, and, it's, you know, the earliest laws are 1796, and looking from then till 1996, there's lots and lots of regulation. But the rise of gun rights advocacy is a very recent phenomenon. Organised gun rights organisations really only crop up in the last quarter of that story.
Well, let's go back into the past, because you reveal things, and a lot of the stuff I had no idea, that New South Wales and Victoria had a goldfield gun problem, and as well as that rebellion in Eureka.
Yeah, I was fascinated to find this too. You know, this is a book that I'd sort of mulled about for a long time, and when I got into the detail, I couldn't believe the sorts of things that I was finding. And so the goldfields gun problem, which creates really some of Australia's earliest firearms legislation, that it's broadly based rather than targeting specific groups or specific problems. These are laws just about not carrying guns around in the street willy-nilly. And they respond to the gold rush, the numbers of people coming in, bringing firearms, going out into the fields with firearms. And many of those are from California. So it's these Americans bringing guns into Australia in the 1850s, which creates our first concerted effort at gun control in that respect.
I remember doing a story on Eureka Stockade, probably 15 years ago, and learned from the guest, whose name I can no longer remember, that the Colt 45 featured at Eureka Stockade. It was one of the first international sales pitches.
Yeah, the arrival of the pistol, the repeating pistol, is one of the big problems in the history of gun control, really, because it's portable and it's very, very dangerous. And people like to just shoot them off willy-nilly. So one of the early instances that prompted this sort of reform is a Californian who got off the boat in Sydney, went to a few establishments, clearly got a bit inebriated, and decided to impress some boys in the street by firing the gun in the air. And, of course, the local constabulary didn't take too kindly to that, and that sort of triggered this, you know, what are we going to do about these people firing these things off in our streets? So it's not just the kind of over-the-top dangers of Eureka. The irony, of course, is that New South Wales introduced a law to regulate this stuff and Victoria didn't. And Victoria is the one which ended up with a rebellion. And, of course, the government just resolved that by making a proclamation that's a de facto state of martial law, so no guns for anybody except the soldiers.
I was intrigued to discover that long before the official White Australia policy, we had a white gun policy, because back in the 1840s, there was legislation or laws making it illegal for an entire race to carry firearms. Guess who?
Yeah, this is one of those cases, I think, where we need to be wary about too much firm approach to gun control, because gun control can, of course, be used to the detriment of specific groups of people. And in Australia's history, the most disadvantaged group are, of course, Aboriginal people. So not only were guns used to win the wars against Aboriginal people out in the field, to dispossess them through violence upon their person and communities, but Aboriginal people from the 1840s in the Port Phillip district, because some of them were seen to be acquiring firearms, they were disarmed. They were deliberately disarmed by the government and denied the ability to acquire those firearms. So that way, legally maintaining a huge tactical and technological advantage for the wars that would follow.
As we know, the Americans are very, very proud, or the NRA is very proud of the right to bear arms. Was that a part of our attitudes in the 19th century? Did people feel that it was, in a sense, a God-given right?
Certain groups did. So those 1850s laws to deal with the goldfields problem were eventually repealed within about a decade because of concerted effort from local business groups who just enjoyed pigeon shooting. And it's that nexus of business and politics. Those guys like to go out shooting on the weekend, so they're the ones who really quashed the law. But beyond that sort of gentleman caste, there's not that strong sense until very, very late. What you really have through most of human history, really, is a duty to bear arms. The duty to bear arms predates the right to bear arms by a considerable length and has a much greater effect, really.
Nick, tell me about the pistol plague, your term, during and after World War One.
Yeah, this is one of those things where when you do a history like this, you're sort of following the detail, and then you've finished your draft and you step back and you can see the big patterns start to emerge. And the pistol is what really made me realise one of them, which is that every time there's a major war, there's a new technological development with a gun, which then triggers a new gun crisis in a way. Basically, the manufacturers of firearms tilt their efforts to civil markets. The soldiers come home often with guns from, you know, ex-service weapons or pilfered weapons. And so in the 1920s, all of the First World War soldiers coming back were bringing pistols, either those that they had with them or those they pilfered from Germans or Turks or so on. And of course, the pistol manufacturers no longer had a war to sell to. So they started to very aggressively market towards the Sydney, towards the civil markets. And in big Australian cities like Sydney and Melbourne, you basically saw a huge degree of problems. You saw gang crime, where people had these concealed automatic pistols that could be used for all sorts of hold-ups and bank robberies and all those spectacular things that attracted press attention. But you also had, you know, guys at home playing with their guns and accidentally shooting each other on a huge scale. You also had a overwhelming phenomenon of domestic violence as soldiers coming back, obviously with PTSD and so forth, are taking that out basically on their loved ones. And so there is a plague. The pistol is a real problem, and there's an international effort to control that. And so people from Australia go to New York to look at the laws there to model them for Australia.
As a farmer, I've got a well-locked gun cabin with a few guns in it, which are necessary to deal with various ferals principally. And I'm aware that all the time there's pressure from the bush on city legislators to be less aggressive on these issues. And you note that urban gun problems and solutions often met this country resistance. Tell me about, the 1920 Gun License Act.
Yeah, so one of these responses to the pistol crisis is New South Wales introduces a Gun License Act, and it's that idea of licensing weapons. And almost immediately there's pushback from the country. The bureaucracy of the Act hadn't been terribly well thought out is part of the issue. One of my favourite discoveries is some local in Wagga Wagga had just bodged up his own licences that he was selling to people, and the police got up him. But the reason they were unimpressed is because he had typographical errors in his form, not because he'd actually done it. So you've got that going on, but you've also got the urban gun sellers. And they are the ones who really arc up the country people and create the sort of feedback loop of political pressure that's going on at the time. The laws themselves weren't terribly well understood at the time that they were being argued against. So the government started on a back foot, basically because they failed at publicity and informing the public about what was going on.
Somewhere in your writing, there's reference to size not being everything. I can't find it now, but there's a charming story you tell about barrel length.
Yeah, so part of the reform of that then is to introduce, make the law target pistols. And so it defines a pistol as something that has less than 9-inch barrel. And of course, immediately you have manufacturers who are producing 9.5-inch and 10-inch barrels and selling them. And so it becomes a huge farce, and you've got crooks standing up in court and, you know, they're saying, oh, you wouldn't have me if I'd had my 10-inch with me, you know, and all of this sort of stuff. So the crooks actually know how to circumvent the law. So it's really never really about the criminals and what they're up to anyway. It's more about that everyday gun use, gun mishap is where most of the law reform's at.
But as you point out, the gun license law had little impact on Sydney's infamous razor gangs, who, of course, were using those shaving blades as weapons because guns were getting a bit hard to get.
Yeah, well, exactly. The famous razor gangs proved that the gun laws worked fairly efficiently. Guns, you know, criminal gangs could still get hold of guns, and you've got cases where people are just breaking storefront windows and taking them because the guns are still on display. But it's harder to get, and if you're caught with one, then you're in much, much more trouble immediately. Whereas if you've got a razor, then, you know, it's still a concealable weapon, it's still a close contact weapon, but you're not going to get in quite as much trouble, and they're very easy to get and cheap and effective. So that's basically why we have the razor gang thing.
Sorry, in introducing tonight's program, I made the inevitable contrast between Australia and the United States. Given that there are parallels in the way our nations were established, have you come to a conclusion about why we took such absolutely different paths?
Fundamentally, I think it comes down to a creeping fundamentalism about the Second Amendment in the 20th century, largely driven by those manufacturers and their close friends in the NRA. So Australia had an NRA before America did, but we didn't
have... I'm sorry, run that past me?
Well, the NRA was invented in England in 1859, and Australia had ones in each state within the next decade. Most Australian colonies had an NRA before America did.
Good heavens above. So... But they sort of died out here. I know there are still politicians who are beating the gun drum pretty loudly and demanding that we loosen the lid, you know, loosen the laws. But we don't have a fully fledged gun lobby, do we?
Not a very effective one, not in the same way. And it's really the pivot. So Australia, like America, the NRA started as one of those volunteer movements. It's a rifle club, basically, a glorified empire-wide rifle club, and Australia had those, and the First World War and then the Second World War trained us out of those, and we no longer needed those. We now had permanent standing armies, and America is the same. So the NRA had to then pivot its attention after that, and what was it going to do? And it became more a training community organisation, but with close ties to a huge gun manufacturers, and so there's that constant cultural, economic, military, industrial complex relationship.
I'm of an age that remembers a time when Australian police did not pack heat like the British bobby. They did not carry guns. That happy stage, of course, is long gone. And I suppose that the cops are on the side of sanity. They don't want too many guns around, do they?
Yeah, often the laws are... the law reform that we see each wave is basically driven by frustrated police. They're often the ones behind the scenes trying to agitate for reform to get the politicians on board because of those everyday mishaps. The police are, you know, they're always going to have to deal with a crazy guy who's got a high-powered rifle. But if they can reduce the numbers of high-powered rifles, then it becomes easy to deal with those crazy people. But more importantly, it's the everyday. It's like traffic accidents. You know, if you look at Australia's history, there are weeks where you have half a dozen kids shooting each other in any given week over the summers of Australia's history. And so we've lost that, and that's a great thing, a huge step forward for Australia, that we no longer have those newspapers just filled with story after story after story of gun-related mishap and accident.
Good on you, Nick. Nick Brody's new book is Under Fire, How Australia's Violent History Led to Gun Control, published by Hardy Grant.